I would still say 7 out of 10 organizations are still thinking about UI as experience. And they're structured that way, they're built that way. But in the B2B context, it's actually a much more, as it's kind of called out, it's much more powerful because you have so many more users, you have so many more contexts, you have departments that need to come together, but again, activating around solving a specific user's need.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, this is going to be a great discussion today. For me, the difficulty is going to be making sure that I don't try to cover it all, because the wealth of insight and information that you're going to get during this show, and then also subsequently have access to, can make a huge difference in your organization in regards to growth. Because we have Satyam Kantamneni, and I'm going to work on that last name the best I can, on the show today. Satyam, welcome.
Thank you. It's a privilege being here, Jim.
Now, before we get into this discussion about user experience design and how it actually can fuel growth, if you could share a little bit of the background that you have and experience with the B2B DM gang.
Absolutely. So I actually have been in this line of work for roughly about 23 years. I am trained as an engineer, a designer, and now a business leader. So the trifecta of the three sides of stuff. Fortunately, I've spent a lot of that time working with B2B organizations, both and with my consulting firm right now, and before that, being part of B2B organizations as part of the in-house leadership teams. So it's, again, I feel a big part of value creation is building those software and systems, and I have a lot of things to share, especially in the context of user-centered design.
Well, and I think it's really important, because a lot of times when you start talking about user-centered design, especially when you start talking about the creation and initial viable products and initial launch of solutions, is it comes from a very, very small perspective in regards to what users want. And so we have to make sure that if we're starting to talk about a minimal viable product, who are we making it viable for? Is it truly viable? And then actually, what is it going to be required, and what do we need to do in order for it to scale? And when I was going through your user design practical playbook to fuel business growth, I was like, oh man, this is overwhelm. This is just weight. I'm like, there's so many things here. But then I started reflecting and thinking that, well, you've really kind of created this as an ongoing reference that people can grab and continue to use and leverage, you know, throughout the, quite frankly, you know, entire, you know, life of the company. But you and I were talking about how, you know, your reflection upon creating the book. And I think it's important for you to share that. And if, so if you could, why so much? What would you do different in order to be able to help organizations to move forward faster?
So I think the writing the book was more of a, as you called out, a reference that allows for people to kind of go back to. So when we started working with a lot of different organizations, we identified 27 different scenarios that people kind of come back to us with. It's like, hey, how do I build a team? How do I measure a good experience? What is the experience vision? So these are nuances, the how do I statements. And then we said, okay, we're going to write 27 how do I place for people to kind of go to. But even before that, I think the book itself, that's why I think it's overwhelming, because you, not all 27 how do I's come at the same time. They come at different times, at different times. Once you hire a team, which the first thing is, how do I hire a team? Second is, how do I build a career and a profession for this team? So they're two different places, and they will all probably happen a couple of years apart from each other. But the essence of everything was, how can design be a business driver? And as companies are looking to drive business growth, how can they unlock the power of user-centered design? Now, when you look at the data that's already existing in the public world and markets out there, there is some clear data out there. Why is Apple 10 times more valuable than a Samsung when a Samsung makes everything that Apple does and more, right? It makes refrigerators, it makes televisions, it makes washing machines, and makes every device that Apple has, but it's still 10 times less valuable. Then you start looking at that on the Tesla side. You say, hey, Tesla is still, again, way more valuable than any other automotive company out there, even though other automotive companies have more SKUs and more models and basically have better structuring of logistics, including dealerships. And that's when you kind of go back to the fact, because both of them understand their users well, and they constantly are building a premium. And now they are charging that premium as part of their whatever the experience premium they call. And that is way more valuable and way more impactful. But then you go back and say, why are the other companies not able to do that? And then it comes back to like, hey, just they don't have the system built in their organization. And this book was a way to kind of get them to kind of start getting to that system. And that was what the initial intent was.
Well, you know, as you're talking, I could also, say that there's some naysayers that may say, well, this organization was first to market. Oh, well, this organization, has better, supply, capabilities. I mean, this organization has better logistical, capabilities and fulfillment capabilities. I mean, you can see where people could, potentially discount all that and say, what do you mean by user experience design? So, I mean, what would be your comeback to people who always want to put it away, downplay it, and say that, user experience design just isn't as important and definitely isn't a driver of business growth?
I think, again, there's any organization is a multivariate system. And I'm never going to say that one variable is going to take over and then build more. But the fact that is a user-centered process, is that a winning strategy? Absolutely. And that's what I'm going to talk a little bit about, assuming that others are equal or at least are good enough. Other variables, I mean. So if you have a great, you build great experiences and great products for users, but you can't fulfill it, absolutely you will fail. If you have a great product and you have a great experience, but you can't, users don't know about it, absolutely you will fail, right? So again, it doesn't mean that discontinues or doesn't actually talk a lot about the other lines of work, but I just want to share that if you have a user-centered structure and a system, then you'll be way ahead of competition. That I can tell you. And why is that? Good.
Well, okay. So I think for me, when I put, my thinking on it, I mean, what we're talking about really is how do you become more customer centric overall?
See, I and the word customer is also something I would kind of differ a little bit on, because in the world of B2C, especially, customer was defined as a user who's actually paying for it. In the world of that we work in, we say every person that touches your system is a user, right? And that means internal people, external people, your vendors, everybody is a user. Every person that touches your system, that you leave an impression or through your experience, is actually a user in your system. And the best thing is when we start studying this, the ecosystem experience is another big secret of a winning company. That means they actually have focused on a few users, not just one. And when you focus on a group of users, the stickiness goes up, and it exponentially goes up with every user that you delight in that system. And that is what is the power, because remember that, hey, if I have a Spotify account and I've thought about myself as an account holder, but I also have a kid who also is using that account, tomorrow if I had to cancel it, how many people do I have to get permission from? 2. And then if I have a family, then I have to get a permission from 5. That is a stickiness experience when you start adding more users into an ecosystem. Or any system. And that is the power when you start thinking about a system, the different users, their different journeys, different delight factors. And when you start designing around that, that's when you actually go up exponentially.
Okay. So then I start thinking about, because we're talking about growth, I start thinking about all that from an acquisition, as well as a retention component, and then maybe even a service or success component. So when you say ecosystem, I mean, I start thinking about all kinds of different plays within that ecosystem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially in the B2B context, I mean, again, I'll give you a very specific story that happened very early in my career. I was designing for a healthcare company and designing the UI or user interface or the experience that goes in for a breast biopsy device. Now the doctor is working and is trying to kind of poke this, you know, very thick needle into the tissue to kind of get a sample for doing a biopsy. And my assumption was the doctor is going to hit those numbers and increase the suction and suction or decrease the suction and so on and so forth. But no, the doctor doesn't do that. The doctor is actually focused on getting to the tissue and focused on that. And then he is, in this case, he was passing on the commands to somebody else, a technician. I didn't even think of the technician as the user, right? That now how the commands are passed, how the technician is understanding it. Now there's a whole new variable that has to be thought through and designed as an experience. And that's what I mean. But when you start studying a system, there's so many actors, so many users that work through that. And when you start designing that technician experience, the same way as you design the doctor experience, the same way as you would design the patient experience, because remember, sound is coming out of that machine, which is intimidating by itself. And that is, even though they may be, you know, what you call, having a local anesthesia, but they are effectively are still listening to those sounds. So experiences have to be thought through for every three actors, at least the minimum in that process. And that's how that journey and the experience can be designed.
Okay. So what we're talking about is several different types of research, including ethnographic, you know, type of research. And
absolutely.
Okay. So when you start looking at, I think, a foundational point of, you know, doing, you know, user experience design and product creation, product development, go-to-market strategies, I'm starting to think that there's a whole lot of data on that front end that you're collecting in order to drive some of your decisions. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So the foundation of any user-centered process is understanding the user. And to understand the user, there's a whole line of, professionally trained people called user researchers. And as you called out, you know, you're doing ethnographic research, you're looking at contextual inquiry, where you're observing them in the same context, you're doing a lot of interviews, you're doing immersing themselves in that shoes, et cetera, by just observing and standing there. So there's a lot of that research. So effectively, if you want, and that's what I write in the book too, is like, you know, there are three kinds of research. There is what you call formative research, which is research that allows you to form, what problem do I solve? Then there is summative research. Have I solved this problem, right? When you kind of solve them and you kind of go and iterate and validate that. And there's sensorial research, which is data that you're constantly sensing whether your experience is better or worse. And this is obviously a lot of the new analytical tools like Pendo or Amplitude or some tools like that allow you to kind of build a level of sensorial insights that effectively tell you that, you know, how users liking it, not liking it at any given point, any feature, any touch point, et cetera. And all that together is what insights will allow you to kind of really now go hone in and build that experience.
Well, as you're talking, I also start seeing how this is going through that internal organizational component. And now I have to do product marketing. I have to create, content and context for the sales activities, marketing activities, all that type of stuff. And I'm seeing where a disconnect can often happen. As you're talking about UI, as you're talking about UX, as you're talking about all of that, I could easily take that information and now flip it into, hey, we need to be promoting features and benefits, but that doesn't sell.
No. So features are a side effect. Experiences is what we are doing. And actually, some of the best experiences may have zero features. Best experiences could be as simple as like, hey, I call someone, they'll take care of it. End of story. Now that's a different person and the different user that's going to take care of it. Some of the best experiences are having no screens at all. So that's the mindset between a UI designer and an experience designer is that's the foundation. A UI designer is trying to create a beautiful screen or beautiful artifact that people will interact with. An experience designer is trying to even remove that touch point. And because they want to make that experience as seamless, as efficient as possible. And if somebody else could have done that for you, if you're logging into your computer, do you need to remember your password? Absolutely not. If it can be biometric, it remembers your face, end of story. You don't even touch anything. You come in, it automatically knows that Jim came in and that end of story. There's no screens to engage with. So those are nuances that kind of go in. And as you kind of start, as we are all surrounded by so much technology, that is the power of our experiences coming in. Because think about it, right? You go to an hospital today, it's actually a hodgepodge of at least a dozen different systems that come together. We worked in automotive retail, again, similar thing, about close to about 18 different systems come together, one for payment, one for inventory, one for parts, one for customer data. But then when you start bringing all that together into a single experience for all the different users in that system, that's when value is unlocked. And in this case, we worked with one company that actually challenged three major incumbents that were there for 40 years, and today is the fastest growing in that area. And is growing is worth over $3.5 billion in the last valuation they did 2 years back.
Sometimes that's the easiest thing to do.
Absolutely. But again, it takes a discipline. And I think that discipline is what we are talking about today, is understanding the data, extrapolating that data, passing that on to the other teams. And again, as we talk about experience design is an organizational focus. It should not be a departmental focus, which is what it is today in most of the organizations. And when you say an organizational prerogative, that means if a customer calls, they should not get a different experience from customer support, from professional services, from your self-service product. Today, that's the nature of that you ship your organizational structure and then say, hey, this is your experience depending on the department you work with.
Well, so expectation, consistency, those are critical factors for a lot of organizations. What is your fears that you try to address when you start talking about UX? And let's talk about a contact center, a call center example, where for many organizations, they have the prompt when you initially call and they say, please pay attention because our prompts have recently changed. Well, the fact is, I hear that every freaking time I've called in for the past 5 years. So it's like, it's a pain. And so if I start thinking about change, if I start thinking about, UX design and updates and all of that, because user preferences change. I mean, we have, you even talked about those interfaces of different systems. Heck, if I'm talking about now adding a security component, maybe that dream of single sign-on and a single pane of glass just went away. How do we prevent creating hiccups and false expectations being set and, dissatisfaction coming into play when we're actually doing user experience design?
So let's unravel that, right? So let's talk about the contact center experience today, right? So the contact center experience has different, if you were to break that into a journey, there is a pre-issue, there is a qualifying, and then there is a conversation. Right. So especially if you're calling a contact center, the pre-issue is right when I didn't get my, and I'll give you an example. I was running all the design for PayPal's contact centers. And one of the biggest issue was, I did not receive my item that I paid for. And so that's as simple that. So is there ways that we could be resolving that issue beforehand? So again, when you look at all the insights, when you're sensing the insights that, of this 10 calls we get, 5 of them are related to item not received, then we could kind of proactively communicate, proactively show that data, kind of pull that together. The second pain point is, who do I call? Can I give you a customer service number? And for the longest time, it was treated as an operational problem, not an experience problem. So you would kind of hide the phone number, the an N number of ways of doing that, right? Now, when you start thinking about it, this is where I actually say, let's contrast that with Amazon, where they have spent a whole line of thought just figuring out how to return an item. Returning an item is not the most valuable transaction that a company wants, but they have found 5 or 7 different experiences or scenarios where you can return it at a Kohl's, you can return it at a Walmart, you can return it at a UPS. Someone has spent the time thinking through that experience, because that is what, and that's what loyalty kind of comes together. It's like, again, so you start thinking through those aspects. So these are all calling it. Then the qualifying, as you called out, you kind of start looking into how do I qualify you are you? And how do I qualify that you're calling about this issue, et cetera. Now, this is another thing I'll tell you. Two very interesting data points on our experience. Number one was PayPal. For the longest while, when I was there, we were spending a lot of energy trying to get an issue not to happen. But then we realized that actually, no, statistically, we actually could prove that if an issue happened and we treated you well in that process, you would come back and do more transactions. So us trying to avoid issues was, instead of putting our money there, we started putting more money and saying that, hey, we will make it right as soon as the issue happens. And so what does making it right mean? These are making like anything lesser than $20 item. If you're disputing that, we'll take care of it. Amazon does that now. Right. So they say, okay, keep the item, we take care of it, because that model tells you that that's a better experience and you will come back to me. And again, we have seen that impact even anecdotally. So these are nuances as you start thinking through that journey. And then when you call someone, right, the data they give you, the kind of conversation they're having, all these things kind of are system driven. If I know that, you know, Jim's value in a company is X number, I'm going to treat you, you know, exactly that, because I have the data, I can kind of resolve that issue for you. All those things are valuable. This is where actually, when you start thinking about the contact center experience, you first map the journey, you identify how do I preempt them? How do I kind of resolve them? Where can I create aspects of delight? And that is what you're constantly experimenting on. And that is what the power of designers should be, instead of saying, how do I create a screen that shows you all the data in one place?
Okay, so we're talking about an operational experience, but we refer to business growth. So in that scenario that you're talking about, there's several elements or clusters of, you know, growth and or revenue opportunity. I mean, you know, so if I'm easier to do business with, people will be more likely to do business with me, and they'll refer more business to me. That's a particular element. There's a cost component with that. I can assure you that some of those return you keep it things is really just a cost issue, because the cost for me to handle the return. I remember many, many years ago, I actually did a tour of a Victoria's Secret warehouse in Ohio. And their return area was massive. And there were clothing items all over the darn place. And so for me, I'm like, it took up so much warehouse space and took up so much resources. I'm like, some of these things, you know, a $5 item as far as, and for them, it probably cost $1.50. I'm like, why even bring it back?
Right. No, I think that's very valid. And in this case, can you make, again, can you take these lemons and make lemonade with it? And I think these are the dialogues that need to happen. And how do you make a better experience? And again, when an organization gets activated around that, they talk about it, they experiment around that. Now, that could have been as simple as like, hey, let's experiment with maybe 5% of our users that we will actually let them keep the product when it's less than $5 or $10. Let's experiment that. And then through that, you get data and say whether that increases satisfaction, increases conversion. And then maybe that $5 item can give you $50 of total purchase value in the long term. And there you go. I mean, those are things that actually are experiments. So if I was to kind of summarize some of the things I shared, you know, you're looking at a journey, you're looking at the different delight factors, you're looking at the different experiments you run, you're looking at the data that kind of you kind of extract from that. That whole thing is what is the essence of user-centeredness, right? And that is what we are all trying to kind of communicate, again, on an organizational level.
Okay, so let's put on that B2B hat a little bit more. If I start with what we're talking about here, we're given a couple of consumer examples, but from a B2B perspective, oftentimes you hear the disconnect in regards to an organizational's marketing message and or sales message and to the execution piece. So ideally, when we start talking about growth has two significant pillars to it. One is the retention piece. So
agreed.
We hear about that a lot. But then the other one is the whole, prospecting and activation, element and component. And if we overpromise and underdeliver, we got a problem. And so oftentimes those particular, pillars, and some people can throw another one in there depending on what they do. But product oftentimes is not part of it in the big scheme of things, because we can have a halfway decent problem or product and do very good in these other areas and be extremely successful. The flip can happen. We can have an extremely, innovative, creative, very impactful particular product. But if we're not doing well on the customer success and service component and all of that, we're not going to retain. We're going to churn customers. And so when I start, looking at from a B2B perspective, I start seeing again, the experience, the message, the design, all of those things kind of, it needs to feed into the messaging that we're giving from a marketing perspective, as well as a sales perspective, all parts of that particular sales funnel, top of funnel, middle funnel, and of course, the bottom of the funnel, and then in client success. How do you make sure that all of that as an ecosystem is being executed correctly?
So I'll answer that question. Before answering that question, I actually wanted to kind of call out a construct. And the construct is what I call the experience value chain. And this is the most misunderstood construct in the line of work. There are three levels of value creation. And I think you kind of alluded to it. I just want to kind of call it out for everyone to understand. There is the first level of value creation, which is a UI level, which is like a screen. Like, how do I engage with an interface with with what the user is touching? And that is typically screens, whatever the thing is. Then you start looking into the product experience as the next level there. And the product experience itself is, as you called out, is the product and how the different products work together around that. The third one is the ecosystem experience. This is where the whole organization is activating around that, to your question. And that is when you actually are getting, and again, I'll give you an example. In the B2B context, when you start looking at any B2B software out there, there's a troubleshooting experience, there's an onboarding experience, there's a migration experience. There's a lot of these things that have to come together, and migration can be, worked with a system integrator, migration can be working with a tool, migration can be working with a consultant. There's so many scenarios in that thing. Now I need to think about, how do I enable my consulting ecosystem? And again, if you look at the SAPs, the Oracles, the Salesforces, the ServiceNows of the world, they don't own that final layer of experience. That's owned by system integrators. And that's the same problem we had at PayPal, because everybody would blame PayPal, like, this is a bad integration, but it was never done by PayPal. It was done by the final web developers implementing it. And that's why I think when you start looking at the ecosystem, that's the third level of value creation. When an organization gets to, that's what I call an organization that's experientially transformed. That organization is insanely making value. Again, in this world, there's still companies that are not product experience transformed. So forget the fact that they're thinking about. That's why I say that the value kind of increases. I would still say 7 out of 10 organizations are still thinking about UI as experience. And they're structured that way, they're built that way. But in the B2B context, it's actually a much more, as it's kind of called out, it's much more powerful, because you have so many more users, you have so many more contexts, you have departments that need to come together, but again, activating around solving a specific user's need. The other challenge that's also happening and from the B2B context is, we went from package software to subscription software to usage-based payment. And that's where it's moving more and more at this point, right? Amazon Web Services or any of these, like, hey, here's a free account. I'll give you even $10,000 of free credit, after which you pay us only if you use us. And they'll obviously, take a pound of flesh for that. But the point is that, they have come to the point where, like, hey, you only pay us when you use us. In the subscription software, in the SaaS world, and especially in the B2B context, competition is a click away. And you can immediately transfer, you immediately move. Again, has migration experience been thought through? They still haven't thought through, which is why you still have barriers of exit. But a company that comes in and says, I've thought about your migration experience, I've thought about your onboarding experience, I've thought about your initial time to value experience, where I'm going to give you a freemium and I'm going to give you value immediately, and then I'm going to have features that'll, or systems that'll build better on that. These are where you really start building power. And once you kind of then encircle them with other users in the system, you effectively have the stickiness at a very high level.
Okay. So, I'm thinking, talking about user experience design, being more focused on that and thinking about it from an ecosystem perspective. And then I also hear a lot of organizations talk about value streams. So how do value streams and user experience design fit or overlay with one another or not fit?
See, I think, again, the essence of any value stream is to who's buying it. In this case, typically it is a user who's actually the one who's using it and experiencing it. So if they see that they have a value for that, if they see that it's adding more efficiency or better satisfaction to that, then you start looking through that. And then you kind of experiment through those value streams and you work through those. But again, the essence is knowing who your customer is and who your user is. And if you have that data, you can start now building out the value streams. You can start building out the value propositions. You can start looking at, again, a good product should never be sold. A good product sells itself. A good organization should never be sold. It sells itself because it's solving a need. It's solving a pain point. If in a desert, if you're selling a bottle of water, absolutely it'll sell. Because water is not available as a resource. And I think that, again, knowing who your users are, knowing what the pain points are, again, I'm talking about data that is publicly available, that 40% of the companies ship products and features that are still not even one user has seen before they shipped it. And we're still talking about 30% of the products and features failing because of product market fit. This should never happen. Right? This should never happen. And that's, again, we forget when we talk about the other levels of value, capture, we are still seeing companies fail by doing random stuff because some person has an idea and then they take that idea and they run with it. Again, these are where mistakes are happening. And then again, there are products out there where a feature has been built or a product has been built, but it's very hard to use or very hard to find, very hard to navigate. People don't use it. They'll move to the next one.
Okay. So that leads me into product market fit and go-to-market strategies. I mean, to me, what you're saying is there's corruption and issues and pitfalls that are in both of these particular areas, much like the dichotomy and oftentimes problems that you have with sales and marketing. So to me, give me a little bit more detail on that product market fit and the go-to-market strategy.
So I'll give you an example of one of the things we often hit when we're working with some of our clients. We say, when we start the conversation, most times we say, okay, let's write a screener for a client so we can go, or a user for that particular client. And so we can go find them and talk to them, interview them, engage with them. And when we start seeing that the screener is written for a user that doesn't exist, we automatically start seeing that this product is being built for someone that doesn't exist. That's when you start seeing the first issues. If I can't find a user with all my army of people out there, how likely are you going to find them when you start putting your marketing team on top of it and you start using paid media and everything? If I can't find them with a high touch way of finding one user, and that's kind of the first and foremost issue with product market fit. Then when I show you a product, if the person doesn't say this solves my pain, or if I don't understand the pain that this is solving, again, you have a product market fit. See, again, what is a product market fit? That means the market has a pain that this product solves. And this solves in a way that it's intuitive, it's useful, and it's desirable, right? And again, and those are the things that we can fix. We can fix the usability issue, because that means it's harder to use, but it still solves a problem. And that's why you have a high, early adoption, where people will still use a product when it's not hard, when it's not easy to use. But we start identifying these issues beforehand through research methods. We start identifying these through early stages, so you don't have to build a product to kind of for it to fail and then you iterate on that. We have worked with clients where we have iterated on it a few times and said, I don't think there's a there here, and then they've not even gone for the round of funding. And we have also had companies which have millions of dollars of rounds of funding, only for them to realize that I think we were in the wrong place. And that's kind of what we are trying to avoid. We are trying to save that risk mitigation on a product market fit. Now, from a go-to-market perspective, this is where, again, we iterate on the factor that, again, if there's a sizable, instead of the one big problem for go-to-market that we see a lot of time is we see companies trying to do everything for everyone. And we say, and in design world, and especially in our practice, we say, if you're building everything for everyone, you're building it for no one. So let's take a set of users, understand them, understand the pain points, build the best experience for them, and let's land and own that, and then we'll expand. And that's the go-to-market strategy that we have, instead of saying that, oh, this is going to solve every doctor's need. No, is a specific doctor, is a specific context that this solves in, and if they're a large enough user base, let's go own that user base first before we go in and kind of drive that. So that's kind of where we start, again, experimenting and so on and so forth. We're trying to build more focus early on than actually trying to say, hey, this solves every doctor's problem. And answer is, it could. It absolutely could. But then you would need a battery of people that will customize it for every doctor. And then when you're a small company, you don't have that luxury.
Well, and as you're talking, though, I start thinking about, the conflict and the pressure that you may get from, higher senior level founders of organization where they're like, no, this will work for everyone. And they continue to try to push that home. And you're like, that's not the way you're actually going to grow. Do you have situations where you've been so stuck in a situation like that where you've just kind of walked away from the business?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, see, again, I'll say this for myself as also for my organization, that the biggest investment we make is our time. And if we think that our time is getting wasted running a circle that we don't ourselves feel committed on, then, best is to walk away. In this case, I mean, a lot of leaders, again, the ambition of owning the market is different from go to market, right? And that's where I think people mix it up. Like, yeah, absolutely. You want to be the go-to tool for doctors or for, educationists or whoever it is, but you still start with a small segment and own that segment. And it's better to kind of do it that way, because also from a philosophy of user-centeredness, it's much more easy to sense a smaller segment than trying to kind of sense the universe. Because the signal is just so much that the noise is so much that it's very hard to kind of extract the signal out of it. But again, we see a lot of leaders who come in with that ambition, mixing the ambition with the go-to-market. And we say, let's go finer, simpler, let's own a group of users and then kind of drive that forward. And we've seen success with it. It's not some random stuff. I mean, when we see companies having focus, companies having better data, around that focus, they effectively are able to be much more, tighter. But again, in this world today, there's so much example of companies that have built niche products and built, significant value doing that, than actually trying to build a Uber. Again, I strongly believe that the companies the success factors, the SAPs, the Oracles and all that, they actually did well when they did well because they were the early thing, but they are going to be highly disrupted by niche players, and that's where the value is.
Well, so that's kind of what we were talking about before. Sometimes the legacy can be a crutch, can be an anchor and weigh you down, and you become essentially the disrupted instead of the disruptor. And that's one of the issues. So if you start talking about from an organizational perspective and you talk about growth, you have, initial times where, you can actually feel the growth, but then you have this decline, and we want to be able to turn and have that growth go back up. So if I start looking at that maturation cycle, how can we, I guess you could say, how can we prevent ourselves from becoming the disrupted? It is still going back and being the one who's focusing on the user, and that's still our core and foundational component. Is that what you're advocating?
Absolutely. I think my biggest, and the way I articulate this, is the biggest competition is our user. Users keep changing, their generations keep changing, their expectations keep changing. And we need to constantly be tracking that. We need to constantly be looking at that. And as technology is becoming more and more commoditized, I don't think technology is any more differentiated. It effectively is knowing your user, encircling them, knowing every user. Now, if every organization was to say, if they take their system and identify all the different users that their system touches, they will identify that they only have delighted maybe one or two, they spend their resources delighting one or two users, if they have. So now when you think about it, in the maturity of an organization, they say, I'm going to delight everybody at a higher rate than 50%. You automatically have a decade-long plan and off of winning this game, right? So I've seen the Yahoos of the world and living in the Valley competing with the Googles. But the Googles are competing with the user and the user's data, right? And I think that's where the differentiation starts coming together. The other thing is just having a portfolio of experiments. And, you know, a large company should never assume, and this is, again, one of the professors that I studied under, Clayton Christensen, always says the innovator's dilemma. And he, again, you can run experiments that effectively are challenging your status quo today. And it's as simple as like building a prototype and testing it. And the cost of that is a few weeks. You could invest in companies that actually are disrupting. So there's a ways that companies can still, as long as you know where your user is going, where the pain points are, where the tactics are going. We have a software tool that we use, which is sold at $70,000 a piece to an organization. But I think the need for the user is, I want to run two studies. That's my need. That's the picture I want to hang. I don't want to buy the hammer and the whole Home Depot around with it. But again, if somebody understands that need, there you can build a $1 billion product on that. So I think these are nuances that once you kind of keep tracking what the user wants, what the pain points are, who are the different users and what do they want, how are they interacting with each other, there's so much value that can be created. And again, the disruptor today can get disrupted tomorrow if they lose focus on that.
Well, okay. So then talking about the retention and also the growth piece, I mean, how can a B2B marketer and seller, or actually I should say, what should they be thinking about in order to change their current situation and experience that more growth? What's one thing that you would say, look, this is what you need to do in regards to selling and being able to acquire more new customers?
I think the foundational, I'll probably give two quick things there instead of one. The first thing is know your ecosystem, know each user in that ecosystem, and then identify the pain points that each one has. See, again, pain points are the way I define them, and the way we define them in our line of work is if something that is they are willing to, it's paining them, they are willing to kind of take care of it. It's not a vitamin. And if as a marketer, you know the pain points for the different users in your system and you have a solution for that, effectively, you just have to make sure the connection happens. That's as simple as that. For a salesperson, you have to make the simplest process for that sale to kind of go through, whether that's a quick trial, a quick experience, whatever that is, that's how do you kind of think through that. But again, it all aligns on who are your top users or and what are the top pain points. And then you kind of make sure that you're in the right place with that right product.
Satyam, awesome conversation. I mean, and it's something that oftentimes marketers and sellers don't look at when we start talking about, you know, being able to acquire and then therefore also go through the retention process to be able to fuel that business growth. So great insight. How does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
They can easily send me a note on LinkedIn, Satyam Kantamneni, or they can reach out to through my firm, UX Reactor. The best way is hello@uxreactor.com. I'm sure all of these will be linked in the show notes. But other than that, again, there's I'm always open to having a conversation. This is something I'm very passionate about. And the challenge and one of the reasons also writing the book was putting it out there because we can't work with every one of them. And therefore, putting some of these toolkits in people's hands that we leverage here is actually powerful. So again, I'm happy to kind of engage.
Satyam Kantamneni, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate being here.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.